I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome back to Radio Times. The latest jobs report from the Commerce Department announced that 214,000 jobs were added in October, and the unemployment rate dropped to 5.8%. While that is good news and signs of an improving economy, wage growth has been lackluster in recent years. It grew just 0.1% last month, and the median household income remains stuck below 2008 levels. Our guest David Leonhardt calls this trend the Great Wage Slowdown. He wrote about it in Upshot, that's the New York Times website that covers politics and policies, where he is managing editor. He has some ideas about how to reverse the wage decline for the millions who are struggling to make a decent living. And David Leonhardt, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be back.
So how long has this decline or this slowdown, how long has that been going on?
There's actually a bit of a debate about that. So I think the most useful way to date it is about 15 years to the start of the 21st century. Household income peaked in 2000 once you control for inflation and has never gotten back to that. Incomes grew very slowly during the first part of and middle part of last decade when George W. Bush was president. Then we had the financial crisis, which caused them to take a big hit. And since Barack Obama has been president, they have started to recover from that financial crisis, but they are still not back to their 2009 level, let alone their 2000 level. Other people point out that wages have been growing slowly. We're growing slowly for much of the late 20th century, and that's true. They grew quite slowly in the 70s. They picked up a little bit in the 80s. They then were slow again in the early 90s, and they picked up a lot in the late 90s. So it's not wrong to say that we've now had 40 years of slow-growing wages, but we've now had 15 with virtually no wage growth. And so I've been calling it, as you note, the great wage slowdown of the 21st century.
Do you see this slowdown or this wage stagnation? Do you see this as one of the signs of income inequality? Because it's pretty clear that the wealthy, the well-off, have largely recovered since that financial implosion, but that's not been true for a lot of the middle class.
I do. I think there are two basic things going on, and the old metaphor of the pie is a useful one here. The size of the pie being the American economy, it being the total value of the goods and services we produce in a year, which then is also the income we have. The total size of the pie has been growing rather slowly during this period. But in addition to that, the share of the pie going to the people who already had the most pie has been increasing. And so you can think of it as essentially the pie as a whole is growing slowly, and nearly all the gains are going to a relatively small segment of people, leaving the rest of us with just about the same size of pie that we had 15 years ago.
So is it that there are too many people still looking for work, a kind of supply and demand situation, or are there just fewer jobs for people, and that's helped to create this situation that we're in?
I think it's a number of things. So one, I think that and this is where I tend to have the most dispute on these issues with some people on the left. I think education is really a big part of what's going on here. There's a notion, and it's both on the left and on the right, that education is overrated, and I think that's just wrong. I think if you look at the pay gap between college graduates and everyone else, it is at a record high, which suggests we do not have enough college graduates. We used to have the world's most educated workforce. In fact, our 50 and 60-year-olds are still the world's most educated 50 and 60-year-olds. Our 20 and 30-year-olds are not the world's most educated 20 and 30-year-olds. And so basically we don't have enough high-skill, high-education people. They're still doing okay. They're not doing great, but they're doing okay. The unemployment rate for college graduates is about 3%. As I mentioned, the wage gap between them and everyone else is at a record high. So one problem is that we're just not producing as many well-educated, highly-skilled workers. We're not increasing that at the rate that we used to be. Another is that our tax system over a 40-year period has changed so that we ask substantially less of people at the top. Now, it's true they pay more taxes, but that's because they're making so much more income than they used to. The amount of tax they pay on average of each dollar they're earning has gone down. So it's education. It's the fact that, our government tax system and spending system is less so-called progressive than it used to be. And then it's the fact that our economic growth just hasn't been good over that great overall, which is also connected to education.
Well, let me pick up on education, and this has been such a critical issue here in Philadelphia, and I think in certainly across the state, and I think in a lot of other states as well. You're seeing government cutbacks, you're seeing teacher layoffs, and it doesn't seem as if many of the state governments are looking at this question or this issue or investing in education in perhaps the way that you think they should.
That's right. And I know it's been a big issue in Philadelphia. And although I don't follow Pennsylvania politics super closely and wouldn't want to pretend to, my sense is that it has been more the Republicans who have been cutting spending on education. And wasn't that one of the things that people were quite critical of
yes.
Governor Corbett about?
Indeed. Yeah. Yep.
I think there are some hopeful signs in education. I think some of these movements to introduce more accountability into schools, I think some of the innovations seem to be actually working pretty well. Some of the results on things like charter schools, not necessarily overall, charter schools are no magic bullet, but some of the better performing ones really seem to be doing better. There have been some encouraging results in Texas recently. But it's not just about accountability for schools. It's also about whether they have the resources. And education is a societal investment that brings an enormous return. It brings an economic return. It seems to bring a return in terms of health and happiness. And the notion that we would cut back on it, despite the enormous good that education has done for the United States over the years, from an economic perspective, I find to be totally baffling.
Well, and I wonder, I mean, there was a time when getting a high school degree could get you a pretty well-paying job, a middle-class type job. Are you saying that everyone should try to get to college in one form or another, or is there a place, a role for technical or vo-tech, you know, vocational training and education?
There's definitely a role for vocational education. We definitely, I mean, regardless whether you think we should get to a society in which everyone has a college degree, we're not close to that, right? And we need to make sure we have a society that functions well, not just for people who have 4 years or even 2 years degrees, but also for others. I mean, we're still only about a third of the population, adult population, with a 4-year college degree. Having said that, we should say that, hey, we want to aspire for everyone to have a college degree. First of all, a lot of the people who you hear saying college is overrated, everyone doesn't need a college degree, those people don't say that about their own children. They mm-hmm. have no doubt that their own children should go to college. And so what they're really saying is I think my kids should go to college, but I'm not sure that other people's kids should go to college. And I don't find that a very persuasive, for me, but not for the argument, doesn't strike me as very persuasive. The other thing is, I think we should ask ourselves, what is it that's magical about 13 years of education? You also wouldn't hear anyone saying, well, you know, not everyone needs high school. A middle school education is enough for some people.
Not anymore.
We've gotten to a point as a society in which we think, you know what, everyone needs to graduate from high school. Everyone. Not that everyone does, but that everyone should. And that is a place that we got almost a century ago. There was a big fight over it. Should we go to universal education, or are we wasting high school on the masses? Do they not need it? And the people arguing that we should have universal high school won the debate in this country. They didn't win it in some other countries initially, which is part of why we were able to have the world's most educated population for a while. And so if we got to the point early or in the middle of the 20th century where we agreed that 13 years of education was the minimum that everyone should have, I'm skeptical that there's something magical about 13 and that we should always be there. Our society is much more complicated. We have a much more technically and technologically advanced economy than we did 75 or 100 years ago. And if 13 used to be the magic number of education that everyone should aspire to, I don't know what the number is today, but I'm confident it's more than 13. So maybe we should say that absolutely everyone should aspire to get some sort of certificate or two-year degree. And many people, more than we have now, should aspire to get a four-year degree.
Let me pick up on something you said earlier, David, and you also wrote about this in your New York Times piece on Upshot, having to do with you actually call for a tax cut and believing that if there were a tax cut, I guess, aimed at the middle class, that would help reduce this great wage slowdown. How would that work? Which taxes are you talking about?
There are two separate issues here. There is the long-term things we need to do to lift the economic growth rate and make sure that the economic growth that we have is more broadly shared. So again, to come back to the pie, so that the pie is growing more quickly and so that the gains, the expansion of the pie is shared in some way that is more equal than is the case today. The kind of things we need to do for that are more important than anything short term, but they're long term. They're going to take a while. They're investing in education. They're probably building better infrastructure than we have. They're probably having a saner tax code. They're probably getting rid of some more of the waste we have in the healthcare system. The problem is we now have a situation in which a lot of people are frustrated about the here and now. And while I think the notion of a tax cut aimed at the middle class would have been a little silly even a few years ago, we had a huge deficit. Both Presidents Obama and President Bush cut taxes for the middle class. I don't think it's so silly now because, one, the deficit has come down a ton, and two, we still have this situation in which we have middle class and working class and lower income people aren't getting a raise. And so some sort of package that cut taxes for people in the middle and toward the bottom, and if you're worried about the deficit, also maybe raise taxes again on people at the top. Again, they're still paying lower taxes than they have for most of recent history. Strikes me as a serious idea that should be considered. And what taxes? I think there's a pretty interesting idea that some people in both parties have talked about, which is cutting the payroll tax. Mm-hmm. We often focus on the income tax, which it's true is skewed quite high. But the payroll tax is skewed more toward the middle and the bottom. It's the main tax that large numbers of Americans pay. And maybe that's the right way to think about a payroll tax, a tax cut.
And about a minute before our break here, and the other thing about the payroll tax is that it's a flat tax and it has an upper limit. So it really does fall in many ways on middle class workers.
Yes. I mean, I'm sorry I'm not remembering the number off the top of my head, but I think it's close to half of taxpayers, maybe more, who pay more in the payroll tax than the income tax. So we talk about the income tax so much more. But for a very large number of Americans, it's actually not the bigger federal tax they pay. I do know there's some concern that by cutting the payroll tax, we could potentially damage the long-term budgetary position of what the payroll tax pays for, which is Social Security and Medicare. But in the end, I think money's mostly fungible. And if the payroll tax is the one that's really hitting a lot of people, I think whether it's temporary or permanent, I think that's the kind of thing worth being considered. I would be shocked if we see it happen in the next 2 years, because I think we're going to have basically paralysis in Washington. So the question is whether it becomes part of the debate in the presidential campaign.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. David Leonhardt, our guest, he's managing editor of The Upshot. That's the New York Times website that covers politics and policies. He had a piece recently about what he calls the Great Wage Slowdown. Calls are coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I am talking with David Leonhardt, and he had a piece recently in the New York Times exploring the policies and politics that have created what he calls the Great Wage Slowdown. He's managing editor of Upshot in the New York Times, and we are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. If it seems like you or sounds like you, we do want to hear from you. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. David, I was doing a little homework in preparation for the interview today, and it seems there are some sectors in the economy where there is job growth and even good-paying jobs. I'm thinking about some of the energy jobs that we hear about, even some in manufacturing. Seems like where things are stuck are in things like hospitality, retail, food service. Do you see a split even within these so-called middle-class jobs?
There is something of a split, and I think some of it is between industries, and some of it is within industries. It is not the case that the economy is adding only low-wage jobs right now. It seems to be adding some mix of low- and high-wage jobs. What it's not adding enough of is middle-wage jobs. And that, again, comes back to the education conversation you and I were just having, which is it is adding high-wage jobs in a bunch of fields, and they are overwhelmingly jobs that require a college degree. That's why the unemployment rate for college grads is just 3%. That's why the pay gap between college graduates and everyone else is at a record high. We're not adding enough of those jobs, but we are adding some of them. The real deficit are these sort of middle-income jobs that we just don't seem to be adding enough of right now.
I think there were five states during the midterms that voted to increase minimum wage. Varies from state to state. How much do you think, David, that would actually help middle class? And I think the minimum wage now is something like $7.50 an hour. Hard to imagine you could have a middle class income or raise a family on that kind of money.
I think that's right. I think, look, the minimum wage, increasing the minimum wage, which is extremely popular when it goes on the ballot, as you noted, it passed. It passed in five states. In Illinois, it was non-binding, so it will rise in four. That helps lower-income workers, and it really does help them. It's not a free lunch, meaning someone pays for it. Essentially, what that does is it redistributes income from everyone else more toward lower-income workers. But it's hard to get too upset about that because lower-income workers, A, you can argue they need it more, and B, they've received much smaller raises than upper-income workers. So you could say it's redistributing, or you could say it's unredistributing the income redistribution that has already happened toward the top in recent years. The problem is it doesn't really help the middle that much, right? Middle-class people don't tend to be making right at or near the minimum wage. And in a way, I think that is the frame. That's what it's part of what got me thinking about the tax cut, which is the sort of question right now, I think a big political and policy question is, what is a version of the minimum wage increase for the middle class? What is something that is very simple and immediate? It doesn't take years to work. I'm not saying we should ignore the things that take years to work. We need to do those too. But what is something that is simple and straightforward and could lift middle class pay very quickly and clearly? And it's hard to see anything other than some sort of broad-based tax change, be it a tax cut or a tax credit. And that is, I think the minimum wage is a really good frame to think about this issue.
I was watching Ken Burns' series on the Roosevelts on PBS, and one of the things that were many interesting things in the series, but one of them was about the GI Bill. This, of course, after World War II, but helped to create a middle class in the 1950s. Is there any, do you think, equivalent that would work in today's economy?
The GI Bill comes, as you can tell, whenever we're talking about living standards and economics, I think so much of it in the long term comes back to education. I think the GI Bill was very important because it built on the early successes of the universal high school movement in this country that helped make the United States the first country to get to something that looked like universal high school, first large country, and then you started sending more and more people to college. I think one of the things that was really important about the GI Bill is it took people who wouldn't otherwise have gone to college, took people who wouldn't otherwise have been increasing their education, their skill, their ability to function well in an ever more complicated economy, which was true back then as well, and it got them more education. Some of the education policies we have today, I worry, are essentially giving money to upper middle class families whose kids would go to college anyway. I am sure it would be nice if you were one of those families to get some money. If someone wanted to write me a check, I would cash it. But that isn't really the biggest need. The biggest need is not financial aid for families that are making $125,000 or $100,000, even if that's not enough to make you rich in a place like Philadelphia or Washington or New York. It's enough to make you richer than most people. And so I think the part of the lesson of the GI Bill is it's really important to have a policy that doesn't just help people who are already going to do something, but to have a policy that essentially makes it possible for people who right now aren't graduating from college to graduate from college.
And I'm thinking about student debt currently today. I think it's something like average $25,000. And for some, you hear about, you know, $100,000 or maybe $200,000 in debt once they graduate either from college or maybe medical school or law school or some kind of graduate school. And it just seems like it's a really tough way to begin a career when you're saddled with so much debt.
It is, although I'll be a little critical of my own profession here. I think we in the media have not done a great job covering student debt. You just framed it exactly right. The average for people who graduate from a four-year public, all four-year, I think, is $25,000. We in the media have spent way too much time writing about people who have $100,000 or $150,000 in debt. We've made some of those people look like the norm. They're extreme outliers. $25,000 happens to be, when you adjust for inflation, the amount of debt that I graduated from college from.
Oh, and interesting.
Boy, did I hate paying off my student loans, writing that check every month. But you know what? Having $25,000 in student debt and a bachelor's degree is so much better than not having a bachelor's degree or having any student debt. $25,000 is an amount of money that it is possible to repay without it affecting your entire life for the vast majority of college graduates. And so I do think we need to worry about the cost of college. I worry much less about the kid with a bachelor's degree and $25,000 than I do about the kid who goes to a year or two of college, gets no degree, and ends up with $10,000 or $15,000. That kid has huge problems. And so I think what we really need to do is make sure that we have fewer college dropouts, and we also need to make sure that we basically don't have these companies, whether they're for-profit colleges or, frankly, not-for-profit colleges or lenders, getting kids to take out debt they don't need.
And that's David Leonhardt. He's a managing editor of Upshot. That's the New York Times website that covers politics and policy. And he had a piece recently that caught our eye about what something he calls the great wage slowdown. The fact that, yes, there are some signs of life in the U.S. economy, but wages have been essentially flat for some time now. And the median household income has been stagnant for the last 5 or 6 years as well. We want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. What do you think about what we're talking about, and does this sound like you? Let me get Stephen from, looks like, Center City, Philadelphia to join us. Hi, Stephen. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Mr. Leonhardt asked that he didn't really see anything that could help the middle class immediately. My suggestion is that the SEC pass a rule not allowing management at companies that are publicly traded to be paid by way of stock options, stock warrants, et cetera, because what happens is the companies then go into the stock market and have to buy back the stock that they use for these stock options for the compensation, hollowing out the profits for the companies, and then they say they don't have the money available to pay for wages. And that seems to be a major problem.
Well, Stephen, that's an interesting point. Let me see what David Leonhardt says in response. What's your thought? What are your thoughts, David?
First, I invite all callers to call me David.
Okay.
I appreciate the Mr. Leonhardt. I think there are two things there. I do think that the executive compensation is now large enough to matter materially. I think one of the reasons why we have slow-growing wages is because so much of the fruits of economic growth have gone to the top. And a lot of that, or a portion of that, is about executive compensation. A portion of that is about how much of our economy is now in finance. And so I think I agree with Stephen that is part of what's going on here. My reading of the history is that laws and regulations that essentially mandate how companies, the form of executive compensation, don't end up having a big effect. Because if stock options are outlawed, companies will come up with another way to pay executives. As I said before, money's fungible. I think that the most likely way to affect executive compensation is through tax rates. I think if you have higher top tax rates, right now the top income tax rate is, I believe, 39.6%, much lower than it has been for most of the last century. That's even after President Obama raised it. I think if you have higher tax rates, it means that that people have less incentive to fight for, you know, the 10 billionth dollar because they're going to keep less of it. And B, even if they do fight for the 10 billionth dollar, 10 millionth dollar is probably a better phrase, that the rest of society, the other taxpayers, then get more of that dollar. So my guess is the best way to affect executive compensation is through the tax rates. But I could imagine some other things like the SEC having some kind of an effect as well.
Stephen, thanks for the call to Radio Times. David, does anybody actually pay that 39.6% after deductions and all of that?
They do. And so I think that's important. You're right that people find a lot of ways around it. You're right, particularly that in finance, because of the carried interest rule, which I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with, basically allows people in finance to count a lot of their compensation as an investment and pay essentially capital gains tax on it. It is true people have ways around it, but I think people shouldn't be too fatalistic about tax rates. The lesson when you look over the history of tax collection is when you raise taxes, you raise taxes. And that when tax rates were much higher, people at the top paid higher taxes. And so while they do have some ways to get around them, an increase in the top marginal tax rate still is a tax hike on people with really high incomes. And another way to think about that is, think about how hard various interest groups fight tax increases. If they really had easy ways to get around most or all of the tax increases, they probably would just let it pass and know that, in fact, they had other ways to get around it. But at the end of the day, a tax hike taxes.
Let me get looks like Paul from Haddonfield to join our conversation. And Paul, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you. I enjoyed this show, and I'm really impressed with the depth of his knowledge about this issue. My question, and he addressed it in part, was what does he think can be done either state and federal level to address the tax issue on the very wealthy? I live in New Jersey, where the governor has made some tough decisions on cutting costs, some of which affect teachers, yet has consistently refused to increase the tax on the very wealthy. And as a cynic, that to me has traditionally been a Republican view, leave the wealthy alone. So I'm curious as to how he thinks that could be addressed.
David, picking up on what our caller just said, because the upshot covers both the politics and the policies related to the conversation we've been having, how do you see the politics of this then?
I mean, I think so. Governor Christie in New Jersey has been very clear in all of his campaigns, I believe, that he does not want to raise taxes on the wealthy. So I think some of what's happening there is New Jersey voted for someone who's twice in large numbers, who voted for someone who supports a particular kind of tax approach. And so I'm not shocked that that's what the state is getting. I do think there's an interesting question about whether the Republican Party is going to start to think a little bit more, not just about whether to cut taxes, but for whom to cut them. Traditionally, over the last 20, 30 years, more, Republicans have designed their tax cuts so that the biggest benefits go to the well-off. That isn't the only way to cut taxes. You, particularly if you start to look beyond income taxes, to look at payroll taxes, you can design tax cuts that benefit the middle class as much or more as people at the top. And so I think it will. I don't know what's going to happen. My guess is it's more likely that the Republican Party will not yet rethink this, at least in the short term. But there are voices within the Republican Party that say, hey, you know what? We should be in favor of a middle class tax cut, not just an income tax cut that's mostly going to benefit the wealthy. I can't see the Republican Party getting to anytime soon to being in favor of raising taxes at the top, but I could fathom them getting to cutting taxes in a way that is very much more focused on the middle.
Paul, thanks for the call to Radio Times. David, do you think the decline of union membership and even just the decline of unions, that has had a negative impact on wages?
Yes. I think workers have less bargaining power than they used to. I think that helps explain why corporate profits as a share of economic output are very high and worker compensation is low. I do think that if you care about middle class wages, it's worth spending some time thinking about how to give workers more bargaining power than they have. Having said that, I don't know exactly what the answer to that is. I don't think it's a structure of organized labor that looks like what it did in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. We just face much more global competition than we used to. And I think there are some sectors where it's harder to imagine the jobs going overseas, in which maybe union representation and worker bargaining power could have more effects. I'm interested in some of the stuff with service workers and janitors, but absolutely, I think that's part of this.
And what do you think it means to call oneself a member of the middle class? And of course, that that's probably different for different people, and it's changed over time. But how do you see that?
Yeah. So, one of the insights of Stanley Greenberg, a Democratic pollster who worked for Bill Clinton, who's married to Rosa DeLauro, a very senior member of the Democratic caucus in the House, is that, to exaggerate only slightly, all white people view themselves as members of the middle class. People tend not to view themselves as rich. A few people do. And whites historically, I think, have not viewed themselves as members of the lower class. Which often many whites view as bound up with race. When you do polls now, though, you don't find huge percentages of people identifying themselves as members of the middle class if you give them the option of working class. In fact, I was surprised. The last polling numbers I've looked at, when people are given lower, working, middle, and upper, it's something like 10% each pick lower and upper, and I'm rounding here, and 40% each pick working and middle. I'm sure you'd get somewhat different answers depending on exactly how you phrase it. I think there's an argument that that's a silly way to phrase it, that lower, working, middle, and upper is combining apples and oranges. But I do think there's sort of a widespread notion that it's harder to be middle class than it used to be. I'm not sure that it's actually harder, but I think life has not gotten better for the middle class at the rate that it used to, and that's why you have such a widespread sense of many people who view themselves still as being in the middle class, I think, worry a lot about falling out of it.
Well, I really appreciate you joining us, David Leonhardt. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Us as well. He's managing editor of Upshot. We have another guest and another topic waiting in the wings. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Earlier this week, President Obama asked the Federal Communications Commission to treat internet access like a utility, essentially saying he favors net neutrality, something that the telecommunications industry generally opposes. Here's an excerpt of what he said.
Ever since the internet was created, it's been organized around basic principles of openness, fairness, and freedom. There are no gatekeepers deciding which sites you get to access. There are no toll roads on the information superhighway. This set of principles, the idea of net neutrality, has unleashed the power of the internet and given innovators the chance to thrive. Abandoning these principles would threaten to end the internet as we know it. That's why I'm laying out a plan to keep the internet free and open. And that's why I'm urging the Federal Communications Commission to do everything they can to protect net neutrality for everyone. They should make it clear that whether you use a computer, phone, or tablet, internet providers have a legal obligation not to block or limit your access to a website. Cable companies can't decide which online stores you can shop at or which streaming services you can use, and they can't let any company pay for priority over its competitors. To put these protections in place, I'm asking the FCC to reclassify internet service under Title II of a law known as the Telecommunications Act. In plain English, I'm asking them to recognize that for most Americans, the internet has become an essential part of everyday communication and everyday life. The FCC is an independent agency, and ultimately this decision is theirs alone. But the public has already commented nearly 4 million times, asking the FCC to make sure that consumers, not the cable company, gets to decide which sites they use. Americans are making their voices heard and standing up for the principles that make the internet a powerful force for change. As long as I'm president, that's what I'll be fighting for too.
That's President Obama in a statement uploaded to the internet on Monday in which he declared his support for net neutrality. Joining us is John Brodkin. He's senior IT reporter for Ars Technica. And John, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
When President Obama talks about treating a broadband service like a utility, what does he mean by that?
Well, he asked the FCC to classify broadband as a common carrier service, which is similar to how the traditional telephone system has been treated for about a century. But he wants to impose slightly different rules than are applied to the phone system. Instead of rate regulation and universal service, what he wants is rules that say that internet service providers can't block certain websites, you know, especially ones that compete against their own offerings, and they can't charge websites for faster access to consumers.
When I think of utilities, I think of electricity, I think of water. Is that a helpful way to think about how the president is framing this issue?
Yeah, that's definitely a helpful way to think about it. The idea that broadband is, you know, part of modern infrastructure that everyone needs. The rules would be different, though, than the ones applied to electricity and things like that. What internet service providers are worried about is that they'll end up having to follow all sorts of restricted regulations, but Obama is arguing that the FCC can basically just pick and choose which utility rules to apply, and that the most restrictive ones wouldn't have to be applied to internet service providers.
Just getting a bit into the weeds, but this is a complicated issue, and many people with passionate ideas on all sides of this issue. Currently, what we're talking about is the internet classified as an information service, and the president wants to put it under Title II of the regulations. Can you explain what that means, John?
Well, as an information service, it is basically regulated sort of like a website. There aren't many rules that that ISPs have to follow as information services. The background is that the FCC tried to ban internet fast lanes, which is the idea of that internet service providers can charge websites for faster access. But they did that without classifying broadband as a utility. Verizon sued because they said the FCC couldn't do that, and the court agreed that the FCC can't do it unless they classify broadband as a utility.
And under if we're talking about under Title II regulations, some of the complaints are saying this is using 1930s laws and regulations to regulate a 21st century phenomenon.
Yep, that's what the internet service providers and, you know, some conservative think tanks and Republicans in Congress are saying.
Let me just give out the phone number and also how to contact us on Radio Times, because we want to hear from you how you where you come down on this whole issue of net neutrality. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Let me just break down a couple of things that the president talked about. He talked about no blocking, no throttling, increased transparency, and no paid prioritization. Let's break all that down. What does he mean by no blocking?
He means that internet service providers can't prevent their users, their customers, from accessing a certain website or certain applications. Like, they wouldn't be able to block Netflix or Skype, and they wouldn't be able to block the NewYorkTimes.com or any other website.
And no throttling?
Throttling means slowing services down. So, you know, an internet service provider like Verizon or AT&T or Comcast, they wouldn't be allowed to slow down something like Netflix or YouTube or Skype. And, you know, the worry there is that they would try to slow down things that compete against their own voice and video and phone services.
And you also talked about no paid prioritization. What does that mean?
The idea of paid prioritization is that a website or a content provider that delivers video or whatever over the internet would be able to pay the internet service provider for better access to consumers. And the reason people oppose this is because they feel that smaller websites, startups, would not have a fair shot at reaching consumers if the richer ones could pay for better access.
I mean, is it helpful to think that this is a way of empowering consumers or giving consumers more control or control over what they get and how quickly they get it?
Yeah, I think so. It's just it's the idea that consumers should be able to access any content on the internet at the same speed. And that all content providers, whether they're rich or not rich, or startup or a $1 billion corporation, should have a fair shot at reaching consumers over the internet. That basically, internet service providers are just there to give you access to the internet. They're not there to decide which websites and services you should be able to use at all or at the fastest speeds.
And if we're talking about ISPs, we're talking about Comcast, Verizon, who else?
AT&T, Time Warner Cable, smaller companies like RCN or Charter, CenturyLink.
A bunch of them. Now, we're talking about the FCC. This is an independent agency. There's a chairman, a guy named Tom Wheeler. What has he said, even before the president talked about net neutrality? What has been his, I guess, reading of this situation?
He has said that he opposes blocking and throttling and internet fast lanes, but at the same time, he has so far not completely embraced the idea of classifying broadband as a utility. Back in May, he and the fellow commissioners voted on a proposal that would prevent blocking but allow fast lanes because it did not use the utility rules. Then more recently, he's trying to find some sort of compromise where you would do a hybrid between utility rules and weaker rules, and that led to a lot of protests, and he has not yet said whether he wants to do a full reclassification as utility, which is what Obama has called for.
I mean, do you think he's feel? I don't know. I know you don't have a special access to how he feels about this, but clearly the president going so public on this put some kind of pressure on Wheeler and the FCC.
Yeah, it definitely puts a lot of pressure on Wheeler. One thing, though, that a lot of people point out is that Wheeler used to be a lobbyist for the cable and wireless industries. So people argue that, well, if Obama wanted strong net neutrality, he shouldn't have appointed a lobbyist. But at the same time, Wheeler has shown himself to be willing to fight against wireless carriers and other issues like throttling of unlimited data plans. So it's not a given that he won't adopt the strictest approach, but we don't know yet.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's John Brodkin. He's senior IT reporter for Ars Technica, and we asked him to respond to the president's announcement earlier this week, a statement calling for net neutrality. It's an issue that's been kicking around for some time, and it's caused quite a controversy depending on which side of this issue you are on. And again, we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. And again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Let me see what David from Drescher has to say. David, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, this is a great show. Hey, I just wanted to know what your guest thought would happen if the internet service was regulated like utility. I'm thinking back to the 70s and 80s when telephone service was very poor and very expensive. And I just want to know if your guest thinks that would happen to internet service.
Do you think it would, John?
Well, I think internet service is already really expensive, so I can hardly see how it could get more expensive.
But I guess the question is, part of the question is you know, who's going to control this? And if this falls under the government, which I think the critics of what the president was saying, that their feeling is if it falls more under government control, there'll be more regulation, there'll be less innovation, and that's going to hurt the internet and internet access. What's your response to that?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if anyone really knows what's going to happen there. But one interesting point is that the reason that prices are so high is that there's no competition. Most people don't have a choice of more than one or at best two providers. Now, if the FCC were to reclassify broadband, one thing they could do, this isn't likely, but they could force companies like Comcast and AT&T to give other internet service providers access to their lines, which means they wouldn't have to build out new infrastructure. Now, this is something FCC is very unlikely to do, but it's actually a way to create competition where there is almost none. And if they did that, if you suddenly had competition where anyone could use the infrastructure, then that could drive prices down.
But they'd have to share the infrastructure, right?
Right.
I was reading that Netflix, about one-third of all internet traffic in the United States is Netflix. Did I read that right?
During peak viewing hours, you know, essentially prime time, Netflix has ranged from somewhere around 30 to 35% of all data sent over the internet in North America.
So where does Netflix and Amazon, YouTube, where do they come down on this issue? Then we'll get back to our callers.
Netflix has been very outspoken in supporting Title II reclassification. They also want something else. They have been, this is a little complicated, but they have been paying Comcast and other ISPs for access to their networks. Now, this does not count as a fast lane in the net neutrality debate because it's happening at the edge of the network instead of inside the network. I don't know if you want me to explain that anymore, but essentially what they want is free access to the ISP's networks, or at least cheaper access. And so they've probably been the most outspoken opponent of the ISPs, at least among big companies.
Let me see what Stan from Plymouth Meeting has to say. Stan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. I actually work for one of the large ISPs, and you just brought up one of the questions I was going to ask. With the peering agreement, so like Netflix pays, I guess, Comcast a certain amount to have access, direct access to their network, where before they were going through a middleman. How is that going to be regulated under Title II? From what my understanding is that wouldn't fall under net neutrality because that's a direct peer-to-peer network. The other question that I had was if you go under Title II, from my understanding, like, let's say you go by the voice rules, so it's 0.007 cents per bit. So if you went through that scenario, companies like Google, Netflix, and such could be paying billions of dollars for internet access on their own, as well as the consumers paying for upload and download for any content they receive.
Stan, thanks for the – yeah, no. Let me give John Brodkin a chance to weigh in. Did you understand that?
Yeah, I think so. In terms of peering, most net neutrality – peering is when one network connects to another, when Comcast connects to another internet service provider or to Netflix. Most net neutrality proposals would not govern peering. However, I was talking to a lawyer yesterday who said that if broadband were classified under Title II, theoretically Netflix could complain to the FCC that they're being overcharged. That doesn't necessarily mean the FCC has to do anything, but it does raise the possibility. I didn't totally understand the second question, but I think it had something to do with regulated rates. They probably could regulate rates under Title II, but President Obama specifically said that the FCC should not do that.
We're almost out of time here, but I noticed that Senator Ted Cruz said that net neutrality is Obamacare for the internet. And I raise that just because I, in 45 seconds, interested in the whole politics of this and where you think, John, this will go.
I honestly have no idea what he means by Obamacare for the internet.
I think it's just using the word Obamacare, but nonetheless.
Yeah, well, there's definitely a political element. But the thing is here that the FCC is an independent agency. It can do what it wants. This is most likely, no matter what the FCC does, it's probably going to get sued by the ISPs. It's going to end up in court again. Congress could try to pass a law preventing the FCC from doing what it wants to do, but then the president would just veto it. So I think ultimately it's going to come down to the courts.
Well, on that note, John Brodkin, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times, helping us understand what this is all about.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Senior IT reporter for Ars Technica. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about this program, including Twitter, Facebook, podcasts, and much, much more. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.